And we're with John Dvorak. Dr. John, of course, is the author of Earthquake Storms. We'll get more into his thoughts about the seismic lull in California and things that you might be able to do to prepare. Plus, he, of course, also heads up the incredible telescope in Mauna Kea in Hawaii. We'll talk about that, some of the things they peer through that telescope and what do they see, comets, the multiverse. He is very interested in that as well. So we'll be back with Dr. John Dvorak on Coast to Coast AM. Back with Dr. John Dvorak. John, so some of the tips for earthquake preparedness, education, of course, structures to buildings and bridges. And also, you know, if you're in a building and something hits, get under that table and hope for the best, huh?
Well, yes, that's right. Stop what you're doing, duck under something, and hold on.
Hold on for dear life as well. Now, let's talk that's about right. this lull one more time. Then I want to get into some of your work on Mauna Kea. The lull that's occurring, are they predicting the window that something could happen?
No. Since it's impossible for anyone to predict an earthquake, the best that we can do today is just predict the probability. And so these are probabilities that these events are going to occur within, say, 30 years.
But these probabilities are pretty likely based on historical record.
Well, that's right. As I mentioned, there's a 99.6% chance of a damaging earthquake. And people go beyond that. For example, at the Hayward Fault. The Hayward Fault runs on the east side of the bay up in San Francisco. And that fault, it runs through Hayward, San Leandro, Berkeley, Oakland. There's about a 30% chance that's going to rupture. And then people also point down to the San Jacinto Fault. That runs from San Bernardino down to Riverside, and that also has a 30%. But the one that people have their eye on and are most concerned is the southern part of the San Andreas. From roughly the Salton Sea, which is close to the border with Mexico, up to just north of Palm Springs and possibly up to Cajon Pass. And that has a surprising, roughly a 60% chance of a rupture in the next 30 years.
2005, we got hit with one of the most powerful, destructive tropical storms ever, and that was, of course, the Hurricane Katrina.
Yes.
We saw how unprepared government was. They couldn't do anything right, John. Are they prepared if we had a major earthquake of a 7.8 or bigger in a major metropolitan area? There would be pandemonium.
Well, that is the crux of the question. And one of the things that people should understand is once the earthquake happens, there is going to be an immediate meeting of a group of people known as the Working Group of California Earthquakes. And they are going to confer immediately to sort of judge what has happened. And they are going to talk directly to the mayors and the governor and the president. And, of course, the response of government comes from those people. But they will be informed immediately as to what has happened and what is likely to happen in the next few hours, in the next few days.
You know, John, when you buy insurance, you hope to God that you never have to cash in and use it. But, you know, if something ever happens, you're darn lucky and grateful that you've got it, whether it's a car accident or a property loss or anything like that. Why isn't government preparing, insuring us against situations like this? They're just not getting ready. Instead, what we hear is that, you know, FEMA has ordered zillions of body bags in case of a catastrophe or whatever, but they don't seem to have a plan. There's not an evacuation plan if people have to leave. You know, if there was a tsunami coming, and I want to get into what you were talking about the last hour, where you were talking about, you know, if the island collapses, for example, and that's what helps cause that tsunami. If there was a tsunami racing toward the East Coast, and let's say we had an 8-hour time limit to get the heck out of there, maybe it was going to go 20 or 30, 40 miles inland. I don't think we're prepared for that, are we?
Well, in terms, we'll go back to the earthquakes. People have been, people in government, people at universities, a great deal of work has been done for planning what the contingency is going to be as to what is the effect is going to be on the infrastructure and to take it from that point. And it really depends on the on the elected officials. I mean, it's very important who those people are. But when it happens, people should understand that what you see in your normal life is not going to be there. Cell phones are not going to work. The water system's not going to work. The transportation, the power system's not going to work. And it's going to be a matter of how long is it going to take to come back. And the basic strategy that is used is to minimize the damage from the event and then bring back the infrastructure as fast as possible. And that is what people cope with. Sort of the nightmare scenario is, what if there are two disasters? And what if there's a hurricane coming toward the east coast of the United States, and it's projected that it's going to strike in 4 days,
mm-hmm.
and while it's on its way, there's a big earthquake in California.
Oh, boy.
And there's actually a lot of discussion about that. How are we going to allocate the resources? How are we going to get our information out there and our communication?
And then we get an X flare from the sun at the same time, right?
Well, if those things happen, and these are highly dedicated professional people, and they are very much concerned about such things, and they are thinking about contingencies, what to do in those situations. But ultimately, the leadership comes down from the top.
Oh, you're right about that. Well, I'm so glad you've got your workout, earthquake storms. Let's get into your work at Mauna Kea. Take us to Mauna Kea in Hawaii, John. What do we see as we go up, up, up to see the telescope?
Well, what you see is a magnificent sight. It really, truly is remarkable. Most people come into the bay at Hilo. Hilo is the second largest city in the Hawaiian Islands. It's tropical. It's a beautiful place. And it may be the only place in the world where you can be at sea level in the tropics, and in less than 2 hours, you'll be up at 14,000 feet. And up on top of this magnificent volcano, it's the highest spot in the middle of the Pacific. Many people at the summit of Mauna Kea say this is probably what the surface of Mars looks like. It's desolate.
Yeah.
There's cinder cones. There's evidence of glaciers up there. It is stark. But what is really intriguing about Mauna Kea, I'm going to go back to Arthur C. Clarke. Everyone knows who Arthur C. Clarke was, right?
They sure do, listening to this program.
And Arthur C. Clarke, in 1970, a year after he published 2001 Space Odyssey, he came to Mauna Kea, and he stood there, and he said, that was the best place to see the universe from the summit of Mauna Kea.
I love it.
It was better than going into outer space. And the reason he said that is that when you go up to Mauna Kea, you are literally halfway into outer space now. In that half of the atmosphere is below you. So you're halfway to outer space. And unlike being in orbit around the Earth, you always are behind a pane of glass, right?
That's right.
But Mauna Kea, you're able to really see a far stretch of the Earth. The horizon is like 200 to 300 miles away. You look up in the sky, and it's just magnificent what you see with your own eyes. And so truly, for me, I've always wanted to go into outer space. I probably never will. But every time I go up to Mauna Kea, I'm halfway there. And sort of on its different side, my observatory is the highest one on the mountain. And so I literally work in the highest office in the world.
You sure do. I love it. How do you get up there? Do you drive? Is there some kind of escalator that takes you all the way up? How do you get up there?
Well, there's a road. When you get up to you're able to drive on a paved road up to 9,000 feet. And then from 9,000 feet up, it's mostly a dirt road, and you need a four-wheel drive.
Is that four-wheel drive, is it waiting for you? I mean, for people who want to go up there as a invited guest or as just a spectator?
Well, astronomers go up there, of course, to work. And, of course, it's open for the public to go up there. But four-wheel drive is required.
But I mean, how does the public get up there? They've got to bring a four-wheel drive vehicle?
Yes, but they have to. Well, there's a number of tours which go up. There's probably 100 to 200 people come up in these large vans.
Okay.
And they come up to watch the sunset. And then if you want to come up as an individual, if you rent a four-wheel drive out of Hilo, you'll be able to drive up to the summit.
And coming down, I bet that's pretty easy, isn't it? You just put it in neutral and down you go.
Well, yes, that's right. It is steep. Remember, you're going, when you start climbing the steep part of the mountain, you're climbing probably about 6,000 feet in 8 miles. So it is steep.
It's
like going to the summit of Mount Rainier or Mount Shasta. It's that high. And doing it routinely.
Has anybody ever gone over a ledge or anything?
There's usually an accident of some sort once a month or twice a month, yes.
A big one? A fatal one?
I don't know of any fatal accidents recently, but people do drive off the road, yes. Well, the other problem is the lack of oxygen, and people lose the ability to make a decision, and the reflexes are lost. And you really lose almost all of your short-term memory when you work up there.
Are you kidding me?
If you work up there, you have to write everything down. It's just so hard to try to remember things because
really?
You're working at half oxygen.
Well, what if, you know, there's an elderly person who just, you know, can't breathe well? I mean, I guess, would you recommend they go up there?
No, anyone who has a breathing problem should not go up there because the oxygen is only half of what it is at sea level.
Wow. And you're up there almost every day.
I spend half my waking hours at the summit of Mauna Kea.
How's your memory?
The short-term memory is not very good, no.
Really?
But it is, when I'm up at the summit, it's not very good. But it is a magnificent place to work. I mean, it is awesome up there.
Who owns the telescope?
Well, my particular telescope is owned by the University of Hawaii. But there's like a dozen or so, and they're each owned by a different institute, a different organization.
And how big is your telescope? How big is the mirror?
Well, mine is the smallest of the big ones. Mine is 2.2 meters or 88 inches. The largest one is the Keck. And that is 10 meters across, and there's two of those.
About 30 feet. That's pretty good size.
Yes.
And that's up there, too?
And both of those are up there also, yes.
Are they all in the same observatory, or are there different observatories up there?
Well, each of the observatories are operated independently. So they're scattered around the summit.
So what would yours be called if somebody wants to come see you and see your telescope? I mean, what is it called?
Well, mine is called the UH 88-inch telescope. UH means the University of Hawaii.
Okay. What is it like being up that high, looking through a huge telescope at like the Saturn and looking at the rings? I remember as a kid, John, looking through a little tiny 2.5-inch telescope. But I could see the rings of Saturn. I can only imagine what they look like through your telescope.
Well, I can tell you it is spectacular. I worked there not quite 20 years right now. And we've seen everything from rocks that are coming between us and the moon and may someday hit the Earth to the objects right at the edge of the observable universe and everything in between. We've watched a comet break up. We've made measurements of exoplanets, of super Jupiters going around, stars. We've seen supernova. One of the main things we do at my telescope, we're part of the accelerating universe program. So we've done a lot of those measurements. When I first started, we spent a great deal of time watching the weather on Uranus. And it is spectacular.
When you gaze into the heavens, do you sometimes contemplate the possibilities of intelligent life out there on other planetary systems?
Oh, constantly. Constantly. And I think of Carl Sagan. And when he was a young boy, and when I was a young boy, I wondered why wouldn't they land in my backyard and take me up there?
You would have gone.
Oh, yes. Well, for me personally, we have a catwalk that goes around the outside of the dome.
Okay.
And you stand out there in the moonlight. The domes are white, and so they glow in the moonlight. And you're looking across the Pacific. The horizon's like 200, 300 miles away. And then you look up, and you wonder those things. You wonder what else is out there.
I'm a believer in extraterrestrial life. I just can't imagine that we're all by ourselves.
Well, that is one of the key questions, yes.
Of course, I think we've been visited too, but that's another one. You ever think of that?
Well, what was the question?
I think we've been visited before. I just think that this,
well,
this is so vast.
I don't see any clear evidence for it. And it wouldn't be hard to find the evidence. I mean, it would be pretty obvious.
I'd love to get you with some astronauts who are believers, John. It's an incredible series of stories. I mean, they really haven't seen anything, but they say they've been told things. Just fascinating. But, I mean, that's what space is all about. It lets your mind wander and imagine and
yes, people have been looking up at the stars for thousands and thousands of years. And, of course, the basic question, whether it's science or art, you're trying to figure out how you as an individual fit with all this. I mean, what is your place in all this?
Is it sometimes mind-boggling for you? That is so overwhelming?
Mind-boggling. Yeah. Oh, yes.
I would think. What for you has been everything you've seen through this telescope? What's been the most fascinating?
Well, the most exciting one was the breakup of a comet. There was a comet about 7 years ago. I don't recall the name. And it was flaring, which means it was giving these bursts out. And so that was an indication that there was something interesting. Now, this was not flying close to the sun, so it wasn't heating up. And so we looked at it for 3 nights. And the first night, it looked a bit odd, and it was changing its light. You know, it was getting stronger and weaker. And then the second night, we were able to see a couple individual pieces. And by the third night, we could count 12 pieces. And it started to sort of be like a string up there in the sky. So that was pretty impressive.
Were you able to see Comet Ison break up, the most recent one?
No. No, that one was very close to the sun.
Ah, you can see that. Okay, stay with us. So we're going to come back, John, talk more with you about some of your work and also get your views on multiverses next. On our next Coast to Coast program, David Rutherly joins us again as we talk about his work with black-eyed children, his latest work, Strange Intruders. So get ready for that. Scary evening tomorrow on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be back more with Dr. John Dvorak as we talk about earthquake storms and going out into space when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Dr. John Dvorak with us. And, of course, so the breaking up of a comet, what do you think the odds are of us getting hit by an asteroid, John?
Well, eventually it's 100%.
Yeah.
The question is when. We had that event in Russia that was, what, 1 to 2 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
And that was a rather small object. And then we had, of course, what, 1905, 1908, the
Tunguska
event. And we're lucky that was out in Siberia and that it wasn't in a major area that's populated, such as Southern Asia, Europe, or North America. So it is certain. The question, of course, is it's a matter of when.
Well, and if it's a big one, we're in trouble, aren't we?
Well, that's right. And again, just like earthquakes, it's a matter of there are some reasonable things that we can do. To sort of minimize the impact of it. One of them is to take a census of all the objects out there. And that's going on right now to figure out where are these objects and which ones might hit the Earth in the near future.
You know, I was looking at a picture of Temple 1, one of the comets that
right.
comes around every 5-6 years, I guess. What is a comet made out of? Is it, and how did it form? Is it a broken up planet that was in the solar system? What is it?
Well, comets are interesting for two reasons. One, that they were not involved in the planet forming the process, but that's the most primordial part of the solar system. It's these things probably come from a very distant part of the solar system. And so this is what the Earth and Jupiter ultimately were made out of. So people are interested for that reason. Some of them come through on just a single pass, and those originate out there in interstellar space or maybe even from other star systems. And those, of course, are very interesting because that's our only chance to take an actual sample from another star system. But they're probably mostly various types of ice, water ice, CO2 ice. And then there's a lot of dirt there that's mixed in with the ice.
Fascinating just watching them, how they come through and everything else. And Hale Bopp, remember that was the one that, was it Hale Bopp or was it the Shoemaker-Levy? Shoemaker-Levy that hit Jupiter, right?
That's right. The Shoemaker-Levy hit Jupiter. The Hale Bopp was the magnificent one, which you could see up in the sky about, 1996, 1997.
Yeah, that's right. Now, if right. Shoemaker-Levy had hit planet Earth, what could have happened?
Well, those were more than one impact, of course.
That's right. They kept coming.
Those were a half dozen or a dozen impacts that would have produced havoc. There's no doubt about it. And so people are also thinking of, is there a way of diverting? If we find out a comet or an asteroid is on its way, what is a reasonable way to go out there and divert it?
Could it have been a planet killer?
Well, eventually that could happen. I mean, there are objects out there that are large enough. None of them are currently anywhere in the near future on a collision path.
Well, that's a good thing. The multiverse, now, we've talked a lot about it with other scientists, John. Their different
right.
theories. And the conclusion is, from most of them, we have many, many universes out there. And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree. I agree there's probably many. And what's exciting is that we're probably right on the verge of actually getting experimental evidence for that. In fact, we may have it already. And in one case, a great deal of that work was done at my observatory. Now, it still is very much in contention whether it's an actual detection of the multiverse or not. But I certainly expect in my lifetime that somebody's going to announce definitive evidence, and that certainly is going to roll over to a Nobel Prize for them.
And how many universes do you think there are out there?
Well,
who knows, right?
Well, that's right, but most of them are probably not at all like ours. Ours is probably unusual in that it's rather cold here, and the energy density is pretty low. Most of the multiverse is probably a frothing mass of matter and energy without really any time or space to it.
Now, what does that mean? No time, no space.
Well, time is really an illusion. And it comes about because we happen to live in a part of the multiverse in which the energy is very low and it's very cold here. And so what we're seeing are cause and effect. Excuse me. We're seeing things that occur like cause and effect, which we interpret as time. But when you look at what most of it probably consists of, it's probably just this froth of mass and energy going on. The best analogy is when you get down to very small scales of the atom. Once you get down to that level, there really isn't any cause and effect anymore. There really isn't isn't anything like time that goes on. Time is a macroscopic thing that occurs in that part of the multiverse that's cold and the energy density is very low.
Do you believe that some of them could have planets and, you're there, I'm there, they're out there?
Well, there's probably a whole range of parameters which define the other parts of the multiverse. Now, within our universe, there certainly are lots and lots of other planets. What we know is that if there's a parallel universe, it's not a parallel universe that's like ours. For example, there's not you and me sitting in that other parallel universe. And the reason we know this is once we talk about ordinary matter and dark energy, there's no way for that to be in a parallel universe because it would have fouled up the whole thing of the structure in our universe, the galaxies and so forth. So we know that is not out there. But exactly what's out there is certainly up for speculation and contention and so forth.
What kind of discovery would this be, John, if they concluded beyond a shadow of a doubt that the multiverses exist?
Well, there are groups of people. They're going at it very hard right now. And there are two possible ways that it might get detected. One of them, the cosmic microwave background radiation, that's that plasma that sits out there at the edge of our universe. That, if that has patterns to it, like giant circles, that would probably be very clear evidence of the multiverse existing. In the measurements that were made at my observatory, there's something called dark flow. People have heard of dark matter, dark energy.
Right.
People have coined this phrase dark flow, and what it is, let me use an analogy first. You're in a giant swimming pool, and you're floating around. And no matter where you float in this swimming pool, you always feel a current taking you in the same direction at the same speed. What you would conclude from that is that something outside the swimming pool has produced this current, right?
Right.
So dark flow is we measured the motions of hundreds of clusters of galaxies, and they seem to all be flowing in the same direction. And because they extend across a great part of the observable universe, something outside the observable universe must be controlling the dark flow. Now, let me temper this. Very few people are convinced of this. And we haven't come up with any supportive measurements to confirm it. But I certainly feel we're on the edge. We're on the edge of either saying yes or no to it.
Could that be one of the greatest discoveries ever?
Oh, certainly. I mean, ever since Copernicus. Copernicus moved us away from the center of the universe, and then we found out that the Earth, that the Sun is a sort of a typical star, and that we weren't in the center of the Milky Way, and that there are other galaxies, and now finding out that even the universe is not unique. I mean, yes, it will certainly mark up there with Copernicus, Einstein, and so forth, is one of the great discoveries.
That's exciting, this whole area. Let's go back now and review about earthquakes, and then we'll take phone calls with you next hour, John, about things going on in space and earthquakes as well. I didn't have a chance yet to talk with you about fracking, which is pretty controversial these days. And that, of course, is the forceful injection of fluids, water primarily, into the crust to extract the hydrocarbons from oil shale. Does the act of fracking cause earthquakes, in your opinion?
Oh, it's not an opinion. It's a fact. There are many illustrations now, many examples that fracking has increased the earthquake activity. What we don't know is whether fracking can produce large earthquakes. And that's a big part of the debate. We know that small earthquakes are produced by fracking, but we don't know if it can trigger a large one.
A lot of people who live near these areas that fracking is occurring also claim contamination in their wells, their water wells, and their systems. What's going on there?
Well, that's right. When you put down this fluid's going down both to crack the rock, and the rock is hard, and you're trying to pull out the oil. And so this fluid is taking the oil out of the rock. And that is contaminating some of the water supplies. But there's a bigger question about fracking, actually. If we do fracking on a large scale in the United States, it's estimated that the United States will become the largest oil producer in the world. And that is good in an economic sense. But it also means that we will continue to rely on this hydrocarbons for our energy source. And that puts a great deal more carbon in the atmosphere. And that just continues with the climate change. And as you said at the beginning, it's a highly emotionally charged issue. Deciding what is the economic benefits and what are the environmental impacts of fracking.
But they do cause some possible earthquakes, and now they're fracking where? All over the place?
I mean, where is it going on now?
Yeah.
I think it's going on in Virginia. I know there's plans to use it in California. I'm not really sure what the status is. I'm not sure. In fact, I think people are sort of going through what is it in the law that might limit it or open it up. So we're still at the very beginning of it, and we certainly need a very vigorous debate in the public about it, because it does affect our economy in a big way. It does affect our environment in a big way.
How many earthquakes occur on this planet every day?
Well, there's almost an uncountable amount of small ones. In general terms, there's probably a dozen magnitude 5 every day.
Every day.
There's a magnitude 6 every couple of days. There's a 7 every month or so. There's an 8 every couple of years. And there's a magnitude 9, like Sumatra, maybe once or twice a century.
Can you see any kind of specific pattern?
Oh, you mean like an increase or decrease?
Well, yeah, and can we tie anything together here and come up with some conclusion about what's going on?
Well, for the moderate and small earthquakes, the 4, 5, and 6s, there's enough of those that those are pretty much constant. Because the 8s and 9s do not occur very often. And it's possible to get, say, 4 or 5 8s in 1 year and then not have a magnitude 8 for a year or so. And so there really is no indication of either an increase or a decrease in activity. But, of course, once you get a huge earthquake, like the one in Tohoku in Japan 3 years ago,
yeah,
that single event, that released about 5 times the annual seismic energy for the planet. So that was a very big event. So ordinarily, if you look at the average annual release of seismic energy, in those few minutes, about 5 times that amount of energy was released.
These earthquakes that are happening all around the country, are they getting bigger? Or do they still seem to be moderate in terms of size?
Well, there's no indication of increase or a decrease in earthquakes. What we're seeing, and is sort of the topic of the book, is that in regions where we see local increases of earthquake activity, like in Sumatra. Sumatra was extremely quiet until 2004. And, of course, that's the concern up in Cascadia in the Pacific Northwest. That's been an extremely quiet area in terms of earthquakes. But yet, looking at the recent geologic history, we know that it can have a series of large earthquakes.
John, when you started doing this, I mean, did you know, did you think, I'm going to be in there, I'm going to talk a lot about earthquakes? I mean, you love space, you love science telescopes, but in terms of the geophysics of earthquakes, you seem to have jumped right into this. How come?
Well, as I mentioned at the beginning, I'm interested in the dynamics, in the dynamics of the universe, and that's the dynamics on the planet. It never ceases to amaze me to stand at the edge of the Grand Canyon. I go out to the Grand Tetons, and I'm just awed by it. And, of course, when you see a volcano erupt or feel an earthquake, there is this emotional attachment you feel. And, of course, just looking up at the sky at night, there again is this emotional attachment to it.
Well, there's no question about that. I'm glad you're out there doing what you do. You know, we're talking about Jim Berkland and his predicting, and, you know, he seems to be pretty accurate. Do you think people can predict earthquakes, in your opinion?
Well, right now, no. It's clear that no one can predict an earthquake. In order to predict an earthquake, you have to give us 3 things. You have to tell us where that earthquake's going to originate, tell us which fault. You'd have to tell us how big the earthquake's going to be, and you have to give us a reasonable window as to when the earthquake's going to happen. And no one has actually been able to do all 3.
Well, maybe one day. What about someone who's clairvoyant?
Well, that's a different topic. Again, it's a matter of producing those 3 ahead of time and then seeing if it happens. And not just once. I mean, you have to be able to do this repeatedly.
Well, you sure do. All right, well, stay with us, John. We'll come back. Lots of folks want to talk with you about earthquakes and about things that you see through your telescope. So we'll do that next. We'll take phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM.